highly powerful, highly capable AI systems without proper institutional reform is a genuine security threat to U.S. national security and stability.
Welcome to the Center for AI Policy podcast, where we zoom into the strategic landscape of AI and unpack its implications for U.S. policy. I'm your host, Jacob Krauss, and today's guest is Sam Hammond. Sam is senior economist at the Foundation for American Innovation, and in our conversation, we focus on how AI creates an increased need for government modernization and what concretely that government modernization should look like. I hope you enjoy.
Sam, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to hear from you about government modernization and your perspective on AI. I think you've written some really insightful and detailed and original writing on this topic and research on this topic. And to start, what drew you into working on AI?
I suppose I was always interested in AI ever since I was a kid, sort of into philosophy of mind, cognitive science, just philosophy more broadly. I read Age of Spiritual Machines in the early 2000s, and that really woke me up to, you know, the kinds of technological transformations that occur in my lifetime. But at the same time, I was into like economics and political philosophy. And so you can sort of think of this as like my current interest is sort of that blend of interest in science and philosophy of mind and AI with my other interests in how, you know, states work, how governments work, the sort of political science of institutional change. And for the last 8 years, I was working at the Niskanen Center on social policy. But before that, I was actually doing tech policy. So this is sort of coming back full circle. And even my digression at Niskanen was sort of oriented around modernizing the welfare state to be more conducive to, you know, creative destruction and entrepreneurship.
How can we modernize the welfare state for that?
Well, I have a whole paper called The Free Market Welfare State, where I walk through sort of the complementarity between dynamic open markets and strong, largely universal systems of social insurance. And so, you know, as a textbook sort of case study, the Industrial Revolution didn't just mean we had steam engines and roads and electricity. It also meant that we had to update our institutions to reflect the side effects of industrialization, which included, you know, new kinds of idiosyncratic risks, right? So when 80% of people were working in agriculture, their risks were correlated. If you had a bad season, everyone had a bad season. With division of labor and the rise of, you know, modern capitalism, suddenly everyone had different kinds of jobs, different kinds of idiosyncratic risks. And so that pushed, militated towards, you know, the advent of like unemployment insurance, right? These kind of uninsurable risks that are still something that the state can insure through its ability to pool risks. And so when you think about, you know, how AI is going to disrupt many industries, you know, there's debates around, you know, UBI and things like that. That may be a road, a bridge we eventually cross, but I think in the near term, like the best model for social insurance is, I like to point to the Danish flexicurity model, which is flexible security. So they have, you know, very robust short-term unemployment insurance. It could be 100% of your wages, so like very generous in the short run, but it's only for a short period, and then they sort of pair that with continuing education and re-employment support programs. And all within a framework where it's very easy to hire and fire people. So the average Dane changes jobs, you know, 1 in 5 Danes change jobs every year. It's the most dynamic labor market in the world. And it's a side effect of the fact that they have this sort of social insurance setup where it both combines the economic security of people when they're out of work with incentives to get back to work. And it's much cheaper than doing UBI, because it's sort of like a UBI conditional on you not having a job.
Now, you've written about the second order effects of AI on our institutions. you describe those as not only what an AI system can do on its own individually, but what is likely to result as AI capabilities diffuse throughout the economy. So what do you see as some of the most consequential features of these second order effects on US institutions or more generally?
Yeah, so it's sort of a good segue because you know, my interest in the Industrial Revolution and its second order effects is sort of what inspires me. You know, if AI is as transformative as the Industrial Revolution or the printing press or these other similar general purpose technologies, then the second order effects will tend to dominate in the long run, right? There's this notion of the horseless carriage fallacy that the invention of the automobile simply replaced the horses that were pulling the carriage and nothing else changed. Well, actually, what you know, the automobile did was like unlock a new economic geography. You know, you can move goods and services from much greater distances. It, you know, expanded the size and scope of the state because suddenly it was much easier to have, you know, agents of the state in faraway places that could, you know, get there, monitor people and come back and report. And so with AI, I think there's a similar sort of dearth of attention on the likely second order effects. And, you know, my framework for thinking about this is really inspired by Ronald Coase, the famous economist. His famous paper, The Theory of the Firm, argued that, you know, we raised the question, why do we have companies in the first place? Why do we have corporations? If markets are so good, why don't we just do everything through the market? And he pointed out, well, markets themselves, market exchange itself has a cost, right? The cost of monitoring, the cost of searching and finding the contractor you want to work with. You know, anyone who's worked with a contractor knows that, you know, you don't have great oversight. You know, sometimes they don't show up, you know. And so anytime those transaction costs are high, it often makes sense to internalize or vertically integrate that production within a company, so it can be sort of supervised by a management hierarchy. And I think of states and governments as following a very similar logic, right? So, you know, why do we have public infrastructure? Well, because it would be prohibitive to make everyone, every landholder have to negotiate and sign off before they could build a bridge. So with AI, you know, if you look at what AI agents and sort of human level AI agents entails, and this is sort of before superintelligence, it means that any of us could have, you know, 50,000 person corporations beneath us doing all kinds of work. It means that, you know, the classic principal agent problem kind of goes away, you know, insofar as AIs are controllable and do it as you say. They're not going to shirk. They're not going to steal from the till. And a straightforward prediction from institutional economics is that these collapsing transaction costs will drive corresponding institutional transformation, right? So a good sort of micro study of this would be like the transition from taxi cab commissions to Uber and Lyft, where mobile and the internet and, you know, some AI and software on top of that enabled a new institutional structure to emerge, whereas you sort of replace the regulatory governance of a taxi license and you know, public sector commission with the dynamic governance of, you know, reputation mechanisms, search and matching algorithms, you know, dispute resolution systems, and those things just collapse the transaction costs associated with hailing a car, right? You know, you no longer have to haggle with your driver. And so with AI, you know, I just anticipate analogous kinds of changes and changes that will either be adopted by governments, or if governments are stagnant and sort of dragging their feet, will push towards private sector actors developing those platforms and lead to a kind of parallel system. And so my bigger concern is that the degree of sort of institutional sclerosis we have, especially in the United States, will become increasingly dysfunctional as AI pushes for more transformative institutional change and it doesn't actually transpire.
The one part that gives me pause about the horseless carriage is that it would be one thing if AI were automating the horses or bumblebees making honey, or and then also you brought up how maybe we could have at your fingertips an entire company of AI agents that can you can steer and do work with. Well, when I think of this, I think that there would be a pretty short transition from there to the AI leading the company. What do you think this transition would look like between AI agents that are effective in the economy to super intelligent AI, or AI that can, in most meaningful senses, replace human labor?
Yeah, I suppose I tend to think of intelligence and motivation as orthogonal dimensions, right? So, you know, you can strip away all the agency from an AI model, and what do you have? You have sort of a way to construct maps between an input and an output, right? And a lot that embodies a lot of what intelligence is. But how you then take that intelligence and motivate it towards certain ends or goals, you know, that's why you need the reinforcement learning stage to imbue AI agents with some kind of you know, policy that they're acting on. And I think humans, you know, if assuming things don't go totally off the rails, you know, should still be in control at that level, even if in a competitive environment, you know, the company that makes the AI, the CEO, outcompetes the one that doesn't, there will still be, you know, hopefully a human at the top, sort of like, you know, Mr. Burns in The Simpsons, you know, puts the parrot in charge of the company, that is, you know, green lighting decisions, or at least assuming responsibility and liability for, you know, legal matters and those kinds of things. You know, there is a possible world where we develop systems that are autonomous in the way that humans are, and that they develop their own motivations, their own personalities, their own ends. And I think that's a very dangerous world, right? Because these systems, you know, the scenarios where AI goes disastrously catastrophic are ones where we cease seeing them as tools and give them enough autonomy that they could work against our interests.
So you bring up that agency and motivation are orthogonal, is your thesis?
Yeah. Essentially, I think they're two very different axes, in the same way that you can have two very intelligent people who have different goals or interests.
Right. And we've seen a push to build AI agents because you can have a software engineer co-pilot that helps you a lot, makes money. Won't we have a similar pressure to build motivated AI systems?
Oh, absolutely. Right. So like when you talk about having, you know, a 50,000 effective person corporation beneath you, especially insofar as AI is developing in a kind of human-like fashion because it's being trained on human data, the same way that humans are more intelligent in teams and groups, I would anticipate AI also being more intelligent in teams and groups, and also to have sort of analogous kinds of management structures and supervisors and hierarchies. You know, there may be an eventuality where we just have one big neural network that does sort of zero shot the working of a corporation. But I think there's reason to think that there's actually sort of, you know, the sum is greater than its parts when you have multiple agents working together. And you sort of see glimpses of this with the various kind of multi-agent AI team models and so forth. But at the end of the day, you know, those AIs can, you know, today they hallucinate. Today they'll, you know, go down blind alleys and get stuck. But part of my thought experiment is to say, you know, suppose we solve alignment. And I think, in a certain definition, I think the alignment problem isn't nearly as hard as people think. You know, what happens then? You know, so there's been a lot of ink spilled about what happens if the alignment problem, if we don't solve it, and things just go totally haywire. But supposing we do solve it, there's still many other issues that come up, including, you know, if everyone has a 100,000 person corporation beneath them, you know, the world becomes much less legible, right? You know, the IRS hasn't hard enough time dealing with, you know, 150 million tax filers every year. If those 150 million people are running companies that each have a you know, 100,000 effective people beneath them, we simply don't have the scale or scope to deal with that. And so the world, it's sort of an irony, right? Because AI also turns up the sort of resolution on the world, where we can find new galaxies and surveys. We can decode ancient scrolls. And so it makes the world legible in some ways, but in aggregate, I think it makes the world less legible.
Okay. One naive solution would be to have AI handle all the IRS reports for the IRS.
Absolutely.
Is that the best solution? Are there other really important pieces to the puzzle?
Well, I think at first order, a big part of the solution is just keeping up in the arms race, sort of fighting AI fire with AI fire, right? A good example of this is Google DeepMind's GNOME model that discovered 2.2 million new crystals and 800,000 new stable materials, which is, represents 800 years of material science knowledge achieved in an instant. And, engineers and material scientists are working through those candidate chemicals to discover if they're useful. If something like that came to drug discovery, let's say, and there are, many teams working on this, including DeepMind, and we went from the FDA approving 50 new molecular entities a year to having to approve 5,000 or 50,000 or 500,000 new drug candidates every year. It's not sufficient to just give FDA agents, a chatbot copilot. that would make them more efficient at their existing process. But what we really need is dramatic process innovation, where the old model of FDA drug approval just becomes untenable because of the sheer volume of new discovery. And I think you can see that sort of multiplying across a whole bunch of different vectors or domains, not just drug discovery, where the example is most obvious, but the courts, the FOIA, freedom of information requests, up and down the tech stack of government, we're just woefully far behind, and there are all these sort of interconnected webs of bureaucracy that make it very difficult to implement new sort of technology mega projects.
Right. I think the GNOME example is good. I also think the AlphaFold example illustrates this, where I believe the numbers are 200 million proteins that were folded, which would have previously taken a 5-year PhD thesis. And then Google DeepMind's CEO calculated this out as a billion years that they did in the span of a few years. This topic of FDA approval is quite specific. Can you give other examples of outdated or parts of the government that are not currently prepared to handle a high increase in throughput?
Right. So I mentioned FOIA. FOIA, freedom of information requests. We have laws in all 50 states and federal level that allow private citizens to request information that should be, that's not classified from the government, and often governments are slow to respond to those requests, and it varies dramatically by state. Some states get back to you right away. Other states, New Jersey and Illinois are the stereotypes. They'll drag their feet, take years, and then often you have to threaten to sue, because under the law they're supposed to provide that information. Now imagine if you had AI agents that understood all 50 state sunlight law, and understood how to file a motion with the courts to demand that you do that, and also could track every single issue or item of interest and file a FOIA separately for all those different issues. The system will just overwhelm, right? And so one solution to this is to have e-discovery, which is where, on the government side of things, you integrate your databases, you sort of partition the stuff that's classified or that's private and confidential and the stuff that is FOIA-able, and you could install an AI agent that could, be on the receiving end of those requests and instantly filter the information that's being requested and send it back, or if it's, if there's a reason to dispute it. That's one example. I think the courts are another major example, and it's an even trickier one because the courts are very technologically conservative, right? You know, we have, you know, OpenAI Whisper for audio transcription, and they still have, you know, human stenographers. And so that would be my canary in the coal mine. Once, you know, the moment where like court systems begin implementing AI stenographers, I'll have a little glimmer of hope that they're at least, you know, on top of this. Because what would happen is, you know, once we have AI lawyers, and, you know, people will make the point, well, the AI lawyer can't be a licensed attorney. Well, you can always represent yourself and just do what the AI lawyer says. There's this long tail of lawsuits, right, that just never get brought, right? You know, there's like a huge number of cases settle, you know, most criminal cases plea out. You know, the courts are already triaging in ways because they're overwhelmed as it is. And then there's this sort of latent space of cases that just never get brought in the first place because of the transaction costs involved. And if suddenly those, that long tail becomes possible, you know, I think the courts just break down. And simultaneous to that, you know, you could see, like, say, in the corporate realm first, the development of sort of AI judges that sort of serve as arbitration mechanisms or adjudication mechanisms, and not just sort of in a classic sort of court setting, but in ways that could be adjudicating thousands of disputes a minute, right? You could quickly see the development of a kind of parallel system, and once that begins happening, you know, it's not just one government agency. We're talking about like the law, you know. All bets are off. But there are examples of countries sort of anticipating this. The only one I personally know of in the court case is Taiwan. Their Supreme Court has approved the use of AI judges for simple fraud and like DUI type of cases, where, you know, they feed in the facts of the case and the AI judge renders a judgment.
Yeah. My confusion is how to effectively navigate that transition to using AI all over the place. Specifically, there seems to be some sort of uncanny valley where there's all these hallucinations from your judge, or your system has some feature that we find a year later that was pretty undesirable. Whereas later, that seems to me like often a capabilities problem where we could solve that over time. But how do we, are there ways to smooth that transition of bringing in AI systems for usage in all these institutions?
Yeah, I mean, in principle, AI should make transitions easier because it's also a technology for, you know, collapsing implementation frictions, right? You know, older school automations meant you had to contract with IBM or Accenture and like pay them millions of dollars to take 2 years to build you some bespoke model that required tons of maintenance and didn't work very well. You know, that's going away. Like if we have human level agents that, you know, can learn in context and can take directions and understand nuance and don't hallucinate and all those other current limitations, then, you know, in principle, you could say, you know, in principle, the implementation frictions just collapse, right? Because you've built a technology that fits the form factor of a human worker. So existing sort of human-oriented processes don't need to be adapted. I think in the private sector, you're going to see much more rapid adoption, right? Because private organizations are contested. The companies that don't adopt this technology will be competed away. You know, CEOs and product managers can, you know, make sweeping decisions, like when, you know, Steve Jobs famously in the 90s fired an entire product team. So I worry more about the institutional barriers, right? Where, you know, for instance, at the federal level in the US, if you want to change a rule, you know, any rule, you have to give at least 90 days notice, and then you have like potentially a multi-year notice and comment period. Then there's a whole interagency process that this is assuming that no one, you know, sues you in the process and delays the adoption of the new rule. And that's all baked into the administrative process in a way that AI can't solve because it's not a technical problem. It's a social, political problem.
Do you think for the example of spending a really long time to approve decisions, that we should be taking a sledgehammer to it, and then in a few cases saying, no, you do need a long time if it's a nuclear weapon related policy? Or do you think we should be carving out specific parts, like this notice of proposed rulemaking specifically should be shortened?
I would take anything that we can get, but I think that, you know, a sledgehammer is appropriate in a time like this. You know, there's the classic innovator's dilemma in the corporate realm, where, you know, big incumbents become, you know, kind of trapped on the margin because they all their incentives as a large corporation is to sort of service their legacy products and, you know, make incremental improvements. And you know, take Google, right? Google didn't commercialize the transformer first because they saw it could be a threat to search, right? And so they had to be kind of forced into it, right? But you do have sort of exceptions to the innovator's dilemma, right? Like Microsoft is now leading the AI revolution, and you know, that's sort of a flip of the narrative of like what how people used to think of Microsoft like 10 years ago. So it was able to reinvent itself. In the case of governments, you know, there's this constant sort of accretion of, you know, entropy in the system, and you need some way of discharging that entropy, right? So it's far better for governments to, you know, pass laws that have, you know, automatic sunsets, for instance. And in the case of the U.S., we're sort of living off the institutional capital that was built up after the post-war and has over time been increasingly sort of put on rails, right? So, you know, if you flash back to, you know, the Manhattan Project as sort of the textbook example, you have a case of, you know, government acting incredibly nimbly, you know, putting, you know, Oppenheimer and Leslie Groves in charge of this massive secret project where they're at its peak, you know, coordinating over 100,000 people, all working in secret to develop an atom bomb within 3 years, right? You know, they cut corners. You know, they broke the rules, even the limited rules that they already had, right? You couldn't do that. You couldn't build the Manhattan Project through a, you know, NSF request for proposals or some competitive grant process. And so I think we're in need for a kind of regulatory jubilee in a lot of areas, sort of a fresh start where we clear away all that technical debt and figure out what new frameworks are needed in place. Because I don't think you know, laissez-faire is the long run answer. It's just that regulations and policies have a certain direction of fit with the existing technological environment. And if the technology shifts really dramatically beneath your feet, those regulations lose their functionality.
I could imagine some pretty helpful moonshot projects to be done around AI, whether it's an interpretability session or something that's around, let's use AI and solve this really thorny scientific problem that's blocking us from building a really abundant source of energy. And people have talked about maybe we should have the world's governments working together on this in a CERN-style project or an International Space Station-style project. But the Manhattan Project was domestic. Do you think there are moonshot-style projects that the U.S. government should be considering right now? Or is that more, let's wait until AI is really powerful and do those things?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always for more moonshot projects. You know, I'm a big fan of JSTOR Hall's Where's My Flying Car, is that little book. You know, in there he talks about, you know, the value of moonshots is that you're given a kind of high-level goal that is very hard and maybe not currently physically possible with the technology we have. But that achieving that high-level goal induces a bunch of innovation and applied engineering and things that, you know, spill out a ton of innovation and invention. So, you know, the Apollo project was a specific project. Let's get the first man on the moon, right? But to do that, you ended up having to invent a dozen new materials and all kinds of other science. And so, you know, one of JSTOR Hall's proposals is that we should, you know, just try to build a space elevator, you know, not because we really need one, you know, it'd be cool to have one, but because to simply build a structure that big, you'd have to like innovate on like carbon nanotubes and all kinds of stuff. So I think that's actually a better model of science funding, not because big science per se is the goal, but because if you have a big moonshot project that has a lot of moving pieces, a lot of applied research falls out of that. And in a way that can't be replicated through a bunch of like, project specific grants. That being said, I don't think on the margin, governments need to do that much to accelerate science just because of the way AI is heading. What I'm more concerned about is just the sort of basic machinery of government. It's itself a moonshot project to try to, you know, completely turn the ship of state and, get us back to the degree of dynamism that we had under, say, like FDR or Eisenhower, you know, before things became really cluttered. And the reason it's hard is because there are tons of different interests that are pushing and pulling in different directions. A ton of sort of counterintuitive mechanisms that, you know, seem like they're doing one thing, but really, you know, because of these other side effects, they're doing a different thing. And so I think we will, unfortunately, you know, in a better world, we'd have some like farsighted Lee Kuan Yew style statesman who is like, we're going to like completely transform the state, but more than likely, we're going to go through, microcosms of system failure that sort of serve as a forcing function for reform.
Yeah. I imagine some people's resistance within the government to big transformations is that they worry it could go wrong. Maybe they have a low risk tolerance. So even if the bet seems good in expectation, the variance could be prohibitive. What would you say to someone with that concern?
I mean, there's a lot of risk in just stasis, right? I think of this in terms of, you know, in evolutionary biology, they have this concept of a Red Queen dynamic that comes from Alice in Wonderland, where the Red Queen says to Alice, sometimes you have to run just to stay in place, right? We don't really have much of a choice, right? We can run to stay in place. We can sprint to try to get ahead, but if we just stand still, we're going to get swamped by technological and social change, and probably result in a more higher variance outcome in a negative way than if we did try to adapt and co-evolve.
Yeah, there's one worrisome outcome is that you hold off on adapting, hold off, and you build up an overhang where the AI capabilities, when they are introduced in the government, results in really more violent, not literally violent, but striking upheaval and change than they would have if you had started along the way. I think this is a pretty compelling picture for why to do government modernization. And I think most people would say, yeah, let's make the government more effective and using latest technologies and more efficient. So people seem on board with that. What would your recommendations be if you were to start? What are some of the first highest priority items?
Many people are on board with it superficially. You know, they're on board with more flexible procurement for IT projects or something like that. Lots of sort of piecemeal things. Many people are on board for the IRS having a free file portal so we don't have to go through TurboTax. You know, I'm all for all that stuff. I just think the scale of the change that we're going to be going through requires going back to the kind of firmware level of government, right? And the firmware level has, you know, there's many pieces to it. One way you can break it down is there's procurement, civil service, and administrative process or procedure. And those three core pillars are all dramatically broken as it is, right? Making it easier to hire and fire, to bring in technical expertise, to align that civil service with the goals of the deputy or the head of the agency. Then on the procurement side, you know, take defense acquisition, right? Like we are still building tanks and aircraft carriers and so on, even though everyone shouts from the rooftops, this is not how the battles of the future are going to be fought. It took over a year for the Department of Defense to procure their, you know, special custom-made army COVID-19 mask, right? It was like a N95, but it had like custom branding on it. It took over a year. The pandemic was almost over at that point, right? So, and then under administrative procedure, you know, the core law is the Administrative Procedures Act. And like many laws in the U.S., the APA isn't the problem per se. It's been how it's interpreted and evolved by the courts over the years. You know, the same way that like NEPA, the environmental law, was originally only a couple pages, and now it's, you know, because of the way the courts have interpreted over time, it's this huge barrier to building and development. And so that's why I think it needs to just be scrapped and to start from fresh. And the challenge here is that at the end of the day, in the U.S. system, Congress is really sovereign. You know, Congress has the power to change all these rules because none of these rules are in the Constitution, right? But the dysfunction in Congress is probably the biggest barrier to doing this kind of system-wide change, because it's not the kind of change that we can just simply delegate to the agencies to do themselves, because the laws and the statutes in question are immutable.
Okay. So a big barrier here is Congress's ability to act. A big solution to that would be to have something that both parties can agree on. Are there bipartisan aspects to this where you don't anticipate much discord or much disagreement?
Yeah, certainly. You know, in micro cases, there's something in the federal government called the Technology Modernization Fund, which is relatively new. I think it's less than a decade old. And it's essentially a giant slush fund for IT projects that has been sort of centralized under one modernization board that has sort of centralized talent and expertise to evaluate projects, send out people to those agencies and assist them in their implementation. And it's been a huge, a huge positive. It should be funded more. But having, you know, some degree of centralization has been really useful there. And it's something that is bipartisan.
Let's say you were elected to Congress. So you don't have quite the power of unilaterally taking an action, but what would be some of your top priority items on government modernization?
I would try to persuade my colleagues that we need to go big, that, you know, there's going to be a lot of sort of continuous adaptation. So it's not like we can just pass one big law and sort of, you know, call it a day. It's something we need to be on top of. And so, you know, even within Congress, I think there's needs for institutional reform. You know, how committees of jurisdiction are structured. You know, in the case of the IRS, for example, the IRS has to report to, you know, half a dozen different committees. There's been a longstanding recommendation that there should just be one central, like, bipartisan steering committee that, like, when there's complaints about the IRS, they can just go there and they don't have to spend, you know, 9,000 full-time employee hours every year just responding to congressional requests. So those kinds of things, seeing how institutional reform at the congressional level can promote, as a byproduct, the kinds of legislative reforms that I think would be useful. So it's sort of indirect, but that, I mean, if you're only one congressperson, let's say I'm a senator, it's hard to do much else unless you have a large, mandate or there's something in the air. But I think, you know, my hypothesis to date has been that at some point there will be the kind of like Bayesian update heard around the world, sort of like how, like, you know, ChatGPT was the aha moment for a lot of people. At some point, we're going to have the oh shit moment, right? Like, you know, when Tom Hanks got COVID and then the NBA season was canceled. You know, we went from in early January, you know, the pandemic being something that only people on Twitter were talking about. And, you know, Vox was writing articles about, you know, this weird Silicon Valley tech bro trend of not shaking hands, right? Then Tom Hanks gets COVID, you know, everyone who is like, oh, we're not going to do anything because we have the NDAA, like there's no time in the schedule to deal with pandemics. That's all, you know, that all that changed overnight. And within 2 weeks, the WHO declared a pandemic, and then Congress passed a $2.2 trillion relief package. That kind of opportunity, that sort of like, you know, not making waste of a crisis. So I think I would be using my office in Congress to prepare and draft the proposals that would be on the shelf for that moment.
Hmm. This is speculative, but what might that moment be?
It could be a major cyber attack. It could be the release of a model demonstrating much a dramatic improvement in capabilities. You know, we're speaking the day after Sora, the OpenAI's image model came out, and I've just been enjoying reading the comments on TikTok of everyone saying, you know, it's over, we're cooked. You know, all the content creators are seeing that their fate, their days are numbered. You know, something like that that came for that implicated the government in some way, and that could be a cyber capability, or it could just be one of these sort of like, you know, near AGI like agents that, you know, suddenly makes everyone sit up and say, wow, this is not 20 years away. This is now.
Hmm. And let's say that moment comes in 6 months and everyone in Congress is turning to you and they say, Sam, you've been working on this for a while. We're finally ready to take your advice and do it. What should we do?
I think there's too many things in parallel, right, that are happening. You know, this the technology is affecting all these, like the FDA, like the IRS, all these different things all at once. And so I think there'd be a great need for, you know, a kind of commission of sorts that appointed different people to sort of like a presidential transition team that appointed different people to different agencies and said, you know, let's figure out what needs to change. Because I don't have all the answers. I understand the meta problem. but you know, hopefully that would feed back, and then to, you know, have congressional leadership that made it the top priority, and saw it more than just a modernization effort, more than a quality of life effort, but saw it as like a genuine national security issue, in the same way that, you know, China saw you know, social media and the internet as a potentially destabilizing force. You know, we are much more open and so, you know, much more adaptable to disagreement and questioning authority and so forth. So we embrace the internet here, but you know, AI, democratized, highly powerful, highly capable AI systems without proper institutional reform is a genuine security threat to US national security and stability.
Got it. Okay. Is there anywhere that guests should go if they want to learn more about your work and any of the topics we've been discussing?
Yeah, absolutely. Foundation for American Innovations, our website is thefai.org, and my personal Substack is called secondbest.ca.
My guest today has been Sam Hammond. Sam, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Jacob.
Thanks for listening to the show. You can check out the Center for AI Policy Substack for a transcript, links, and more. And if you have any feedback, you can reach me at the email jakub@aipolicy.us. And finally, looking ahead, next episode will feature Jeffrey Laddish discussing AI's intersection with cybersecurity and cyber offense. I hope to see you there.